Well, my name is Leslie D. High. I'm a retired captain of the United States Coast Guard, and I'm now retired. I've only been retired for 41 years. But I started in the Coast Guard back in the 40s during the war, and I was going to college for a couple of years. And while I was there, my dad told me about the opportunity to the Coast Guard Academy, and I went to the Coast Guard Academy. It took me 2 years to get in there, but when I arrived there, I'd already had 2 years of college, so it was very, very easy program. I had been working 40 hours a week in the college. I went to the academy, and I got this all free for doing a couple of square corners and double timing. I graduated in my class and fairly high in the class, so I got the U.S. Coast Guard trainee as my first assignment and went to the West Coast. I did marry my wonderful wife on graduation day, so we both joined the Coast Guard and became Coast Guard people immediately. And from then on, we just found all these wonderful people in the Coast Guard to be part of our family, and that's the way we felt about them. We went to the West Coast. I went to the Taney. They got a new ship called the Acushnet. So then they needed a brand new ensign who they wanted to be somewhat alert. So they picked one of the top guys, and I got to be on that ship. And we took that ship, towed another ship, the Yamacraw, through the Panama Canal, and went to the East Coast and outfitted that ship, the Acushnet, and we went to Maine. And I was on sea duty for 2 years, and then they assigned me to a Lawrence station in Kwajalein as CO. So I went to that training in Connecticut, went to be on an isolated station for 12 months. I was gone about 14 months, and then I got a chance to go to aviation. And when I came back, I went to Pensacola. I got my wings in early 51. I got a wonderful air station at San Diego, great place to start. I got to serve with people like McDermott, who is an expert on offshore landings. So I learned some early on techniques that were just fabulous. I served with many great people at San Diego. Then I got Kodiak as a duty pilot there. We flew out the chain servicing Lawrence stations and other stations, got to do the landing on the side of the mountain and picking up mail, and we flew down and picked it up at 10 feet off the ground. These are all things that aviators love doing. So then from Kodiak, I had a CO that I saved his fanny, so to speak, by he had register publication problems. And so when he got transferred, he took me with him to Traverse City, Michigan, because he wanted me to handle the registered publications. I went to Traverse City, great place. By that time, I was a lieutenant. I got to fly all kinds of airplanes. I noticed the H-03S helicopter was in the museum yesterday. I'm the guy that probably has the most hours in that machine. So that brought back lots of nice memories. Then from Traverse City, I suggested somebody else go on the icebreaker instead of me. I had done my year of isolated duty from my family, so I thought some aviator could go on the icebreaker. Well, we're going to punish you by sending you to Bermuda. So they sent me to Bermuda for 3 years, where they had the Cadillac of seaplanes called a P-5M. And we got rid of those in the Coast Guard at that time, but I got to fly that airplane, and it was a wonderful airplane. As we transitioned to the UF, I was also then training people. One of the interesting stories there, I was showing a guy how to fly the UF, and we had an engine fire, and I was on the right seat, and he said, "You want to take it? You want to take it?" I said, No. This is an opportunity. I'll put the fire out. You land the airplane." And so he was able to go ahead. I said, "Just keep your altitude, and remember when we land, you got to taxi off the runway before we run out of speed, because we haven't got any way to control this speed, the direction of this airplane." That was one of the little incidents. I went from there to the United States Coast Guard Academy, as the staff aviator, and that was a four-year tour. And as soon as I arrived at the academy, the class of 65, who had just come in that year, selected me to be their class advisor. So my wife and I became class advisors for this bunch of guys, and we've been with them now for 55 years. They were just like sons and daughters to us guys. I write to them every year, and they write back. And so even at this event, several of them came. One came from California, one from Colorado, and we had a bunch of people over in Pensacola we met with. These are all class, people are like my kids. But anyway, that was a wonderful acquisition. When I left the academy, they were going to send me to Detroit as a CEO, but they didn't have the money to build the air station. So when they couldn't put me there, they wanted to put me in a significant job. So they put me at Savannah, where we were starting a first standardization program. They'd had a little problem with the H-52, and they were bending that airplane, and so we decided we had to start flying our airplanes in a standard manner. Before that time, the way we used to learn to fly a new airplane, we'd send a pilot to the factory, and he would fly with a test pilot for a couple of flights, and that guy came back and taught us how to fly the airplane. Just ridiculous, unprofessional way to learn to fly an airplane. Well, anyway, we started this standardization program. We had four pilots, four of the smoothest pilots you'll ever know. One of them was Win Corley, Ken Baum, and Max Casper, and a guy named Al Reif. And then I got to become the senior man at running a brand new program. Well, then they decided we wanted to do standardization programs for all of our airplanes, so they decided to get a bigger air station. And they found Mobile, and so they decided they needed a project officer for that. Who was the lucky guy to get to be project officer? A guy by the name of Les High. So I got that wonderful, wonderful opportunity. In fact, that's the reason I'm probably being touted a little bit in this for this particular evolution. Everybody loves Mobile. And they're amazed by this, the old guy that came aboard with a briefcase and a set of orders, and that's all he had. So, and then, of course, my number two guy at the air station was a guy by the name of Don Bellis. And these are mostly aviation personnel, so he ran for the people, and I pretty much ran managing the reconditioning of the air station. Anyway, we had a wonderful project. We got the thing built in a little less. We got it commissioned even the same year we started, and we started our standardization program. Then I became the exec at Mobile for a year and a half, which, can you realize what an opportunity that was? We were starting a new air station, and I got to write all the directives, and so therefore they had less highs tenor on them. I was known to be a firm military pilot, and I was known to get things done. That's why I supposedly got the job. Richmond, head of aviation, came to recruit me to do Mobile, and I was glad that I accepted that opportunity. Of course, he knew, and I knew, he could order me to do this. Anyway, Mobile, he promised me an air station, so he finally gave me Detroit, and I went to Detroit for a normal tour, 2 or 3 years. And while my first year there, I got selected for the National War College in Washington. So I was only at Detroit for 1 year, and then I went to the National War College, and out of there, they assigned me as chief of training and procurement, which is the all the training commands, which had seven in the Coast Guard, including the Coast Guard Academy, and procurement of people, which was all the recruiting during the Vietnam days and so forth. So I had the best job in headquarters, even a better job than a commandant. While I was in headquarters, this was my opportunity. We had been training most of our aviation enlisted people in other schools. And so I hired a guy by the name of George Kreitmeier to do a year study, and he and I knew it was going to be, we could do it better. Well, by that time I moved on, but George Kreitmeier took that study. We got it improved by a commandant. Admiral Seiler was a dear friend of mine, and then he told the next commandant we wanted this program, so that became approved. They got the money. They built the aviation technical training. So I had a little part in that too. So I've had some fun in my aviation days. Well, then it went from there. I went to the one of our largest training commands at Yorktown. I was the commanding officer of the training center at Yorktown, and I was there 2 years. And then after I'd done just about everything I wanted to do, I retired in San Diego, and I've been retired in San Diego for 41 years. I served with Admiral Smith for a long time at the academy when the class was there. He was the superintendent. Well, later on, and when I was running these aviation training programs, I ran an aviation training program every summer. They'd send me three airplanes. I'd start a little unit at Elizabeth City. I'd get the pilots and the crew, and we would have cadets come and become aware of what aviation was all about. In fact, as an aviator at the academy, my wearing a green outfit and so forth, different from everybody else, I was kind of enthused, making these people enthused about being an aviator. Well, Admiral Smith liked what I did. He just liked my being military and being very getting things done, really. But anyway, used to come and visit me. Well, when I started the air station at Mobile, he was the commandant of the Coast Guard. So he decided he wanted to come and see how it was going. So he called up and he said, I want to come and visit you, Les. I'm going to come on Saturday and whatever. I'd been there about 3 or 4 weeks. Well, in the meantime, I heard that there was a C-130 going to Bermuda, we were closing Bermuda, Argentia, and Biloxi. And I wanted to ride out to Bermuda and put tags on all the stuff I wanted. Well, I called up the commandant. I said, well, I got people here ready to brief you. And I said, but Admiral, I'm not going to be here. And he chuckled and chuckled, and he says, only Les High would tell the commandant I'm not going to be there when you come on a visit. So. You like that story?
I do.
Well, that was my life has been filled with wonderful stories like that. Of course he came for the commissioning, and he always liked what I did, and so even though he was the commandant, I'll admit to your tape probably I did things for the Coast Guard. Wasn't particularly seniors didn't bother me. The job was what I was doing, and most of the seniors knew that I was just being less high. And that part of what's happening here today is that many of these people are telling me stories about that I was kind of a firm guy. So. I've had lots of stories, you need some more?
Sure.
Well, I was with McDermott in San Diego, the expert of flying offshore. We learned to do some offshore landings. I'll tell a one little incident. I was flying a PBM. With a guy by the name of Frankie. He was a pilot and I was a co-pilot, and we were both aircraft commanders, but I was the junior guy. And so we had a lady on a sailboat about 200 or 250 miles out, and she had had a diabetic shock, and the doctor said, if we don't get her off the ship, she's gonna die. Well, we went out there, we had about 40 foot swells, maybe 50, but you land parallel to the swells and hope that the chop is not too bad and so forth. Well, it looked fine. We could probably land okay. So we landed, and of course, when we landed, we were in the swells. We were going up and down like this, and every time we went up and down, when we went down, the sailboat's mast went out of sight. It was so, the swells were. Well, anyway, we went upwind, dropped the doctor off in a raft. He drifted down to the boat, examined the lady, and he said, told the husband, she's got to go out with us. He says, no way am I going to send my, I saw you guys land. I'm not going to let her go on that airplane. And the doctor convinced him that she was going to die if she didn't get on the airplane with us. Well, he put her on the raft of the dock. Then, of course, we had to go downwind, and they drifted down to us. We picked them up. It was a difficult takeoff. We had several runs. You have to get going close enough to flying speed before you fire off the JATO. And so we had a couple of runs that just we weren't quite there. When I think it was the third run, we fired off the JATO, got airborne, but just as we took off, I don't know which float it was, but one of the floats hit the water and it smashed it. So we now had a wing float that was smashed in. It wasn't off, but it was smashed, and we knew it wasn't watertight. So basically when we landed, we knew we couldn't let that wing get down. So in those days, we didn't have the bridge in San Diego, so we landed over the strand, which was very low land in the Southern Bay, and came up the bay. And then of course, Frankie and I knew we had to get somebody out on the wing while we turned in the other direction. So we, after we landed, got the people ready to get out of there. And so and as we slowed down, we kept turning until we could get some people out of the wing to hold the wing down. Well, we got the gal back. She saved. And so that was one of my fun things. Another typical flight out of San Diego, not typical, but one I tell my kids about. I can sleep well. I was an aircraft commander in those days, and we used to have a flight, and I was running the section, and we had a call that there was a fishing boat off Cabo San Lucas, which is down the end of the Baja California, and it took us 7 hours to fly there. But we'd get the call in the early evening. We got an injured seaman. We got to get him back to the United States and so forth. And then the public health doctors would try to decide, do we need to go get him? Well, by about, they'd be working at it. We'd find out at 10 o'clock. And we had to leave if we wanted to be there at sunset, we had to leave about midnight. So we'd find out maybe 10:30. I could sleep. I could go lay down, and I could sleep for whatever time I had. Didn't make it over with a half an hour or an hour and a half. But we'd get a little sleep because we'd been up all day now. We're going to fly all night. So anyway, then we'd take off, loaded to the gills. In San Diego, you had to go around the bay, and you had to stay below 200 feet. And here we got a 118-foot airplane, wingspan, and we're flying below, and we're loaded to the gills. And so we take off out of there at about midnight, pick up the person, fly back, get back and land, and it's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Now we came to work the day before at 8 o'clock. I've had about an hour's sleep, and now we've picked up a guy and they're coming back. So that was one of my longer flights. My service career has just been wonderful with Coast Guard people. They as I said to the group the other night, they gave me a chance to talk for a few minutes, I was just pointing out that everywhere I worked, the people that were working with me just made the Coast Guard and me shine. They just used to amaze me, the things that they could do. Just talking about Mobile, I got there and there was this guy, Don Bellis, who was an engineer, and he handled most of the people, but he and I would meet. I kept a log of that particular evolution, so we got a daily log of history of the building of Mobile, handwritten by me, and of course it's in the history log of the pterodactyls. But we would meet each day. We would decide what we were going to do. Our long-range planning was for tomorrow or maybe 2 days from now because it was a new project. There was nothing to follow. We had to go from there. But anyway, we would meet with the two of us and then whoever we thought we needed to be there. And as the numbers grew, we had different people come. We decide what we had done that day for the record, what we were going to do in the next day or so or the next week, and we put it in the log. And it was a briefing document. We knew that as people came, we couldn't spend a lot of time briefing them. So we'd kind of show them the base, let them read the log, then bring them back and brief them one more time on what we wanted them to do, and bingo, we put them to work. And so we had a system that really worked. When Captain Durfee came after several months, he did not change our routine. He used to sit behind me, and as I ran and worked with Don and the people there, and then I turned to the captain and said, "You got anything to add or you change?" Of course, he didn't change anything because I was the one that was started, and I knew where all the things were, and it was a great project because we were closing three air stations, so we had the facility, people, airplanes from three air stations, the money somewhat. Of course, they recruited me. Admiral Richmond recruited me, so I think he really felt, I got to give Les what he wants because I asked him to come here and do this. Now, I can't tell him he can't have stuff. So he made a great effort to so that part was really great. But what was amazing was that the people, the things they did, I'd have an item in the log, painted the west wall of the supply building. That took three words, but that took hours and hours and hours of work. And Don was able to get these people. Now, their standard expression was, "If you ask me or tell me to do it, Commander, it will be done." It was really true. That was the Coast Guard people that have made me shine all through my Coast Guard career. So they give me a lot of credit, but basically it's the Coast Guard people taking care of the Coast Guard and Les High. And I have to admit that they just blessed me. And now they're doing that at this reunion. They're featuring Les High. So But anyway, it was an amazing group, amazing things they did. We needed a new paint and supply building. Our guys weren't doing anything for a while. The Air Force had a contract to build that building. They tried to do it a couple of times. It was $25,000 or $30,000. My guys came to me one day and said, "Commander, can you get me $1,500 and we'll build that building?" And I said, "Come on, you guys can't do that. You're not stone people. We'll figure it out." One guy said he was a stone expert. He saw his dad's do stonework once in a while, so he could do that. And so they built a building for our paint and oil storage to all the specifications that are supposed to be. They called it the Don Bellis building. So that was just one of the simple stories. He painted the hangar, for goodness sakes. His standard expression was, "Give me 5 gallons of paint and 10 gallons of thinner and we'll paint anything." And as you looked in my log, we did this and painted and did this and painted and did this and painted. So I must be entertaining you a little bit because you're smiling. So you like these stories?
Yes.
Well, anyway, that was the unbelievable part. I've read this log a couple of times recently and it amazes me. First, that I was able to make so many of those decisions right off the top of my head. But we didn't have any time to plan. We couldn't wait until next week to decide what to do. We had to get on to the next thing. So Don was very good at he was establishing the aviation engineering area. So he made all kinds of decisions without my being involved because he knew I didn't have time. They were his areas anyway, and of course I made lots that he wasn't involved in. Captain Durfee was a perfect CO because he pretty much let us do our thing. When he came, he did all the CO things. He went to see the dignitaries. I didn't have to do that anymore. Met the mayor One of the things that I really was tickled about. We were talking to the local people at the air station, and they I mean, at the on the field there, and they were talking about they had charges for landing. They were charging airplanes $100 per landing and so forth. And we were talking, how are they going to charge the Coast Guard? And I said, well, you can't charge us $100 a landing. A helicopter going to land five times in a minute. I mean, and so we talked about the nature of things. And well, they said, what do you think would be the proper fee for you? And I said, well, I think we ought to do something like about $100 a month for the Coast Guard. And they agreed to that. So we got the airplane landing rights for $100 a month. Now, this is just one of the simple little things we did when we were building this air station. So, like I said, I got zillions of these stories. But, well, aren't you running out of time?
Got time for another story.
Okay, well, that was the nice thing there. I will admit that at headquarters I really enjoyed that because I may have been one of the first aviation people that got to be chief of training, but that was nice because I had been at the academy as a graduate back in I was a one of the 3-year class we during the war. They cut the class into 3 years to get us out sooner. So I was the last 3-year class.
What was your aviation number?
549, and my helicopter number is 195, I think. Yeah, 195. But I'm kind of an old guy, you know. but I can probably tell some more stories than some of these people because I've been around, but. And that's what's so wonderful. I mean, I got a chance to talk to the people at this place, and one of the things that really has impressed me, we were sitting with some of the award winners last night, the young people, and when one of the young guys said to me, he was telling me the things he heard in what I had a 4-minute, they let me speak 4 minutes, and he was repeating stuff on this, and many of the women were repeating things that they heard. So these young people and women at a Coast Guard aviation meeting, listen to this old guy. Can you imagine that? I mean, most generally, they just wouldn't pay any attention at all, you know? So that part really impressed me. And of course, now everybody seems to know me. Another kind of a fun event about 3 weeks ago, my class went back to the academy, and it was my 70th reunion, and there were 7 of us, 1 widow and 6 of us. And when we marched on the field, they had an honored class of this 50-year class, and they marched on last, but we were just before them, and there were the 6 of us, and we had our little white hats on. It had 47 on. We were graduating 46, but we were the class of 47. We had their little hats, and evidently we looked pretty well. First place, all 6 of us walked on. 2 of them with canes, but I got behind the people with the canes to make sure they got there. But then we came on the field. They made the announcement about us. We were going so slow. They were supposed to be at the end of the play park, but we didn't get there, and so they, I guess as we they were they had a standing ovation for us. These old people coming on the stage. Well, the nice thing about it after that, as we walked around, people would look you'd see them, and you walk toward them, they would smile, and they'd look at your hat, and you could almost see them say, "I wonder if I'll ever make 70." And of course the women would just smile, you know. Here's this old guy, you know, can make it here. And of course the other night, as I was getting up and down on the stage, I could feel the people in the room. I wonder if this guy can make it up there. And they were all cheering. I could feel them cheering for me. Well, see, that's what they've been doing for me all my career. It's cheering for me. And so I feel like a really blessed Coast Guard guy, you know. And to be a part of this organization, the guys that started the organization were Gus Schroed and George Thomas and a couple other guys, and they were in Long Beach, and I was retired in San Diego, and I used to go to all their meetings, and when they wanted to start the club, they wanted me to be a part of the group, and I said, look, I live 100 miles away. I mean, you guys live together, and so I didn't join them, but I really was. I flew with those guys out of San Diego in 1951, and they were two 2 years ahead of me at the academy, and had served in headquarters. I was with Gus Schrode. He was in the office of the inspector's office, and he really liked what I was doing in training. And when they wanted to inspect the academy, I said, why don't you put me on your team? Because the academy was run by admirals. I had the money, so I kind of controlled it. But there were some things I wanted done, like I didn't like the studying hours and all that sort of stuff. And I didn't want to direct an admiral to do that, but I could get the inspector. I'm putting this on public tape, but okay, I don't care now. This stage of my life, but anyway, I they put me on this study, and of course I went there and I told Admiral, I've forgotten the Inspector General. Well, told Gruss, but I mean he just thought this was wonderful that Les High would come and nail his own organization. But I wanted to upgrade. I wanted to upgrade, not for me, it's for the Coast Guard, you know, and that's why I was known as Mr. Coast Guard. I ran into a guy the other night. He was with me at Detroit, and he later became CEO of the air station. And that's the first thing he greeted me with, Mr. Coast Guard. And I was a fairly firm guy. And people, I suppose there were some that are a little afraid of me until they found out that if they served with me and did what they were supposed to do, they had no problems. I smiled a lot. I had my feeling about the Coast Guard was a friendly aloofness. Nobody ever called me by my first name. It was junior to me very often. I particularly when I was commanding officer, that was not a vain thing. I was representing the position of commanding officer. We need to make the commanding officer in command and keep it there. I'm not really a believer in being buddy-buddy. I'm friendly, but not buddy-buddy.